Hi, I'm Julian LaFortune. I'm a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. I'm a researcher, economist by training, who studies issues of school finance and kind of more broadly issues related to California's economy and budget. So when we looked at Los Angeles Unified, they had a massive school facility program, depending on how you count things up, maybe in the ballpark of $25 billion or more over about a 15 or 20 year period. So this is work done with a co-author of mine, David Schoenholzer. We looked at, okay, we had this massive investment, both to build new schools and to renovate existing ones. Kind of what happened to the students and the communities that were exposed to these new school investments? And just before getting into the kind of what happened in the research and quantitative side, kind of a key piece of context here is that Los Angeles, in the time period before we started we looked at in our study, so the constructions were roughly in the early 2000s to kind of about 2012 is when we stopped, and they continued a little bit after, or at least the data that we had goes up to 2012. The enrollment in Los Angeles kind of up to the 2000s from the 70s, 80s, and 90s had grown considerably, and yet they hadn't essentially not really invested in any new school buildings. And so you have this period of massive growth, of massive immigration, especially into areas of LA, like East LA, so predominantly kind of Hispanic and Latino areas, low-income areas, seeing a big influx in enrollment. And yet they didn't build the schools to accommodate this. And so come kind of the mid-1990s, you have this situation where schools were overcrowded, where they were run down. We had kind of anecdotes of there's a high school of 2,000 or so students with essentially one working bathroom most of the time. You had leaky roofs, you had poor air quality, you had, you know, their environmental concerns, gyms and libraries being used as classrooms. About half of schools in the district operated year-round on what they called this essentially multi-track calendar. So you basically had some, you know, students attend 8 weeks on, 2 or 3 weeks off. And then you had several tracks of students so that instead of having kind of a traditional summer break, you could kind of get to, you know, 133 or even 150% occupancy in a building by basically kind of operating it year round and then having these different kind of groups of students and teachers stagger on and off. I mean, it was unpopular and a mess and clustered in some of the most disadvantaged areas of the cities. Students had to be bused around to different schools anyway because there were so many of these buildings were kind of overcrowded. And so what we want to understand is, okay, now come late 1990s, there's kind of a political push to get a bond passed and then a series of bonds passed. So it wasn't just one, but it was a series of bonds that added up to billions of dollars. There was additional state money that came. And then the district kind of embarked on this plan to build, you know, over 100 new schools. And kind of our data set, we look at almost 150 new schools that were built essentially over a 12-year period. And then we analyze, okay, well, what happened to the students that essentially were zoned into these new schools based on where they lived? In particular, ones that switched from an old to a new school to try to identify, one, what's the impact of just going to a new school in general? And two, what's the impact of kind of getting off of this multi-track calendar, this overcrowded, you know, out of these overcrowded conditions? And kind of the neat part of our study, at least I think neat part, is that not only could we see the impact on the students who went to the new schools, we kind of see what happened to the students who stayed behind at these older schools, that maybe they didn't get the new high quality facilities, but they no longer were attending an overcrowded school on this multi-track calendar. And we see benefits for both students. The benefits for the students that switched in the new buildings were much more robust and greater in terms of both kind of attendance and academic gains. So higher test scores, students attending more. Kind of interestingly, you don't see the gains right away. They actually accrue over time. Actually, when students switched to the new school, we see that their kind of test scores and grades went down a little bit initially, and then they recovered and then kind of surpassed after 3 or 4 years, kind of where the trend that they had been on before. So there are disruptions, right? You're going to a new school, there's kind of an immediate disruption. But when you kind of take a step back and look after a few years, you see students were going to school more, they were scoring higher measures of at least standardized tests and grades that we have available in the data. And this wasn't due to kind of better class sizes or better teachers or different kind of peer composition or any kind of anything else that we could kind of measure in the data that you might think could kind of confound that. So we're pretty confident that this is reflecting something about the quality of the school building and the facilities experience that students have. Now, is that greater effort, greater health, greater teacher engagement or student engagement or motivation, right? It's hard to tease all of those out, but that's definitely suggests that there's kind of real promise, especially coming from the situation where they were at, which was just so poor to begin with. So with the same co-author, David Schoenholzer, and another co-author, Barbara Biasi, we kind of motivated in part by evidence from the study in LA, the lack of evidence more broadly on school capital funding compared to larger kind of degree of research and research consensus on these operational parts of the school funding formula that we have. More broadly, we wanted to study, okay, well, what's the impact of school facilities funding in general when we look nationally? And then also, how does that vary based on the type of student district, you know, that's exposed to the funding, the conditions that they had kind of prior to getting this new funding, as well as the type of spending, the type of investments that the spending goes towards. And so we use the fact that most of the time we have bond elections that determine significant amounts of school facilities funding. And in a lot of cases, these elections are actually pretty close. And so what we get are these kind of nice natural experiments in a way where a district, you know, two districts are similar on a similar trajectory. They both propose a bond in the same year. One of them gets 50.1, the other gets 49.8% of the vote. They're otherwise similar in a lot of ways, but the trajectory that we then see over the next 5-10 years in terms of facilities funding is different. And so then we ask, okay, does the trajectory that we see in terms of academic outcomes and then, you know, neighborhood outcomes, mainly kind of the house prices in the area in that district, do those kind of diverge as well between those districts? And what we see is on average, you know, test scores improve, house prices go up quite significantly following this, these increases in these kind of bond-induced spending increases. And so that just speaks to, yes, on average, these dollars are kind of productive in terms of improving student academic outcomes. They're also valued quite significantly by the real estate market, by kind of parents and homeowners and the broader community. But we see interesting patterns when we look, we start to kind of break down the data and look across, okay, what was it spent on and who was it spent on? And just kind of on the what part, we see that effects are, academic effects are larger actually for kind of what you might consider to be more basic infrastructure like HVAC and health and safety, things like plumbing and roofs and kind of facilities components. And then we don't see academic impacts for things like transportation or land improvements or athletic facilities, for example. Now, you might think athletic facilities and performing arts centers and other kind of, you know, extracurriculars matter for outcomes that we can't measure, right? Not kind of test scores, but at least when we look at the test scores, we don't see anything there. When you see what the community seems to value, though, at least proxied for by the house price increases, things like athletics actually stand out as kind of one of the major categories where we see bigger house price increases, and things like HVAC, we actually don't really see house price increases there. And so you get a little bit of this divergence between what seems to at least improve academic outcomes and then the types of investments that maybe are more valued by the broader community in terms of house prices. And so that's kind of the what do we spend on. In terms of the who, when you look at kind of low income versus high income, the effects are all driven by low income districts. There's not much in terms of an additional impact of spending in higher income districts, especially true when you look at districts that have higher shares of Black and Hispanic students as well. And then when you look at districts that have high history of past investments, meaning they've spent a lot on capital before and kind of went back several decades to try to proxy for, you know, how, what type of condition are their buildings in? We don't actually know what the conditions are, but we can see, you know, were you spending a lot over the last 30 years or had you not spent very much kind of per student? And the places that had not spent a lot had bigger impacts than the places that had spent a lot. So kind of suggesting, right, if the facilities were at least way we could measure it with in terms of amount you put in, if they're in worse condition, you had a worse capital stock. As an economist would say, the impacts are bigger. All of which is probably not very surprising, right? We do think that these effects vary a lot, but I think that's important for kind of the policy nuance where we're talking about, you know, often large sums of money that are kind of hard to come by in a state budget and especially hard in kind of a lot of local context. So, you know, it's important to think about, okay, when we want to make the biggest bang for our buck, where should we target these investments and kind of, you know, historically underinvested communities, low-income communities, those with higher shares of kind of non-white students, and then especially kind of investments in often just basic infrastructure components and things like HVAC and health and safety seem to have the biggest academic impacts. And so that's kind of a key lesson for policy there.